Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. And we're in full fanboy flailing mode in reaction to the penultimate episode of the Clone Wars Shattered. With me is my amigos who've been on this journey with me, Stephen Tollefield and Thomas Harper. Gentlemen, how do you feel?
If it says anything, I woke up first thing this morning before my daughter was awake again and watched the episode again, not to prep for our podcast, but just to watch it. So hopefully that speaks for itself.
It is a devastating episode.
Yeah.
And gosh, I love that you call this in the invite to the Zoom the no screaming reaction to the episode. And I almost had to back out because I'm not sure I can
I
promise
can't make yeah, I
that.
can't make that promise.
Exactly. I'm sorry. I'm done. I can't do this. No, but it was a great episode. I'm really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm dying inside. It was so well done. And we can geek out over the like the filmmaking quality and the storytelling depth that this has, just from a visual perspective, after our legal analysis, because we're lawyers and people want to hear us talk about the law. My God, give these people more money, give them a creative budget, let them do whatever they want to do with Star Wars, because I believe in them. Well, let's talk about some of the big Clone Wars issues. And we had a couple fans on Twitter ask some really thoughtful questions, and that went into the outline first. And the first up is the Chancellor's removal from office. Is it the Republican, excuse me, Republic equivalent of an impeachment and removal? Or is it like a military coup with Windu talking about the Jedi taking over the Senate to ensure a peaceful transition of power? And there are a lot of red flags with that. I have some thoughts on how that should work. And Stephen, would you like to go first in talking about the proper way to deal with Palpatine's nefarious nature?
Yeah, I think that we all impeachment is very fresh in everyone's mind, of course, because it just happened in our country, and we observe that there's very clear procedure that's implemented by the Constitution. Well, maybe not very clear. In fact, some of it is pretty murky. But there, at least in this situation, in real life. There were, articles of impeachment were drafted. There was a trial in the Senate. There's very clear process that the president is entitled to when there's an investigation of wrongdoing in office. And there doesn't appear to be any of that that happened in the Clone Wars. So it's a questionable process from a process point of view. But I think Yoda really encapsulated that foreboding when he said that this is a very dark path that we're walking down, that this is going to have very dire consequences, not just politically, but just in terms of the cost to the society of having a question about who is entitled to remove a sovereign from office, and the instability that introduces to the society is very troublesome. And so I thought I was feeling like I was identifying with Yoda quite a bit, which is why I'm wearing my baby Yoda t-shirt. So I was so glad to see Yoda cameo. I think he really sort of hit the nail on the head with that observation.
This question actually came from a law school classmate of mine, so I especially appreciate the origin, Nima. This is a like an outstanding. You could do an entire podcast or a panel at San Diego or elsewhere on this sort of thing because it's really fascinating. Last episode, we talked about the construct, the weird construct of the Republic, potentially is like a pseudo, constitutional monarchy, and you see in Phantom Menace this vote of no confidence that sweeps Palpatine into power ultimately, which is a brilliant move, by the way, because he can point back to Phantom Menace just a few years earlier and say, look, I played by the rules and got elected to this position, and now you have this unelected, unaccountable religious cult that has swept in and seized power effectively, because Mace Windu talks about, as Josh and Stephen both pointed out, taking over control of the Senate to ensure a transition. I mean, that that sounds an awful lot like a coup to me, because nobody's electing the Jedi. In fact, famously, they elect and choose their own members of the council. They don't answer to anybody. And in fact, you see a little bit of that in the venom that Mace Windu spits back at Ahsoka. Like, I'm sorry, citizen, this is a matter for the council to discuss. So this is a really veiled organization, and Palpatine sets them right up to take the fall and look like the tyrannical overlords that are coming in. But interestingly, if you actually go, and I'm not a British government scholar or anything like that, but a vote of no confidence is a real thing. In fact, you saw it fairly recently, a failed one, I believe, in the British government not too long ago. But I think the last successful one was in the late 70s, if I'm not mistaken. But it's a constitutional practice within the British system that's been used from time to time over the years. Effectively, the core idea is that there has to be confidence in the government. And for whatever reason, if there's not confidence because of, a policy decision or a failure of some type, a vote of no confidence can be brought forward. And if it's successful, if a confidence motion is lost, in other words, by the majority party, the government is required to resign. They seek dissolution of the parliament, and then a general election gets called. And you see, Star Wars clearly has a version of that here, and we saw that play out in The Phantom Menace. Not to get into an in-depth discussion of the Jedi, but I think this is exactly what Palpatine wanted, that everybody in the Republic recognizes that when the government isn't really doing its job, it's up to the people and sort of the elected representatives to decide when and where it's time to replace their elected representatives. And by positioning the chess pieces in this way, Mace Windu is at the tip of the spear in trying to subvert that entire system. And I think the true power, and Justin Bolger pointed this out, he's with Fantasy Flight Games, formerly of Lucasfilm, pointed this out on Twitter some time ago and retweeted it after this episode. The real genius of Palpatine's plan was getting the Jedi to abandon their ideals. And this is the culminating point of all of that.
That's a great observation about how Palpatine lawfully set them up to do this. He got the vote of no confidence. It reminded me too that he lawfully got the Senate to cede to him emergency authority to execute the Clone Wars. And so he's very insidiously he's very patiently shrewdly tricked everyone into making it seem like he did all this with their authority. And it's a really brilliant commentary, George Lucas's observation about how tyranny arises from democracy, how people willingly will cede authority to a cult or personality like this, and anyone who challenges it is made to seem disloyal or a threat to the security of the state. It's really interesting.
There's a lot going on, because the Jedi were absolutely wrong with their removal from office procedure. You just don't go cowboy up and take out the leader. There has to be some procedures in place, unless Palpatine was so insidious to knock out a continuity of government plan so there wasn't one, so that he was the state. If that was the situation, they needed to get senators involved. They needed to say, like, hey, here's all the evidence showing he played us. He absolutely manipulated us. He also managed the droid army. He created the separatist movement in order to pit us against ourselves, tear down our civil liberties, and create the situation. That needed sunshine. that needed to be seen by everyone so they could realize he's not the hero, he's the villain. And they didn't do any of that. Yeah. They went for the let's everyone get out our lightsabers. And on the flip side, they should have taken more guys. But that should have been public of, whoa, look at what we just found. And you play by the rules. You know, when, you know, you get a governor or a mayor that's somehow either on the lam, you know, getting money, taking kickbacks. It's not like the police storm the governor's mansion, tackle the guy and drag him out in handcuffs. While that would be therapeutic, that's not how it works. And for granted, I don't know if it was just for dramatic effect or to show how badly the Jedi lost their way, because I still deal with the fact that there was some bad script writing and bad direction in Revenge of the Sith that I have a really tough time separating all this from. That said, the Clone Wars does make this more believable, understandable. They do a really good job of filling in how horrible the situation was.
Even, and you're absolutely right, because even the war itself was lawfully started. I mean, this isn't the case where, you know, the an authorization for the use of military forces passed with a narrow scope, and you can argue about executive power and whether it was right to expand that in the real world, or whether, you know, the executive, like Palpatine, just threw forces at a war with no Senate approval. He had the approval of the Senate, and they continuously reauthorized this conflict and funding for it and supplies for it and all of those things. And so the even you get down to the very moment that he reveals himself as a Sith Lord, that was calculated. This wasn't some like oopsie slip where Anakin is you know, playing Sherlock and finally figures it out. This was the moment where the Jedi went from, well, let's see how he reacts to General Grievous's capture, and then we'll know his true intentions, whether he intends to lay down power and maybe legislatively end this war because their leader has been taken out. The switch gets flipped very, very quickly because the moment that he reveals himself as the Sith Lord and Anakin brings that report back, that's where Mace says, like, let's go get him. We have to remove him at this point. We can't wait for a legislative end to this war or for him to hand back power. It's too much. And at that point, I mean, the Jedi Order has, as Maul sort of put it, is already lost, and they just don't know it. And it's just that it was beautiful, and I really enjoyed seeing it play out in Revenge of the Sith, but this just makes it so much better.
It's well executed because we're not seeing it from the perspective of Anakin falling. And I mean, on one level, I do appreciate Mace Windu in Revenge of the Sith going, he's a Sith Lord? Uh-oh. I'm like, I get that reaction. But that's not how you deal with an elected leader that needs to be removed from office. And doing it, well, I appreciate you don't announce your attack, because that's not how attacks work. But they fought the wrong fight. You know, the fight needed to be, he's the bad guy. He played all of us. And so you have to get the people on board for that. You got to get the Senate on board to go like, time out. We don't like being morons. No, 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 no. How many people died because of this? And take decisive action. That doesn't happen here, because basically everyone that was a Palpatine appointee needs to be thrown out of office because they're all dirty as far as anyone can tell. Does not happen. And we get an empire because of it, which does seem like not the right solution to the problem, but again, call me old fashioned. Well, let's move on to so that's topic one. Let's talk about treason and the clones. And Thomas, can you share your thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is one that I watched the episode yesterday at like 5:30 in the morning, and then immediately came and woke my wife up to try to bounce these crazy ideas off her, because it was just this like fascinating topic, and nobody is awake at that hour except maybe European folks to discuss it. And then, you know, nobody wants to talk spoilers, but you see a little bit more of Order 66 and sort of the behind the scenes, particularly in that scene where Rex explains to all the clones what this order means. You're to kill Jedi leadership on site for treason. Anyone who is, refuses to execute that order will be killed for treason. It's just like wonderful treason sandwich. And what it got me thinking was the clones themselves and their duty to follow these orders, and whether the act of executing Order 66 itself would have been treasonous. And I don't want to go down like a rabbit hole that takes over the entire episode, but there are two tracks of thought here. One being military justice, because they are soldiers in the Grand Army of the Republic, and the other under, at least in the real world, federal law, because they could be prosecuted under either or both. The U.S. Code has a section for treason, 2381. At its base, if you owe allegiance to the United States, or in this case, the Republic, and you levy war against them or adhere to their enemies, which is like the finest phrase, I would expect nothing less in the code section for treason, or you give enemies aid and comfort, you're guilty of treason. You're not going to find a treason section in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but you will find Article 94, which is mutiny and sedition. And that criminalizes the act of acting to usurp or override lawful military authority by a variety of means. So it's this sort of double-layered 1-2 punch. If you look at it from a military order standpoint, this is Palpatine, as we'll call him, the commander-in-chief of the Grand Army of the Republic. They clearly have a top-down civilian-led system. He, within that role, gives Order 66, which is, hey, the Jedi are to be killed. They have committed treason. And when we talk about orders, the baseline rule in military law is that an order is presumed lawful. And it really has to be that way, because you can't have it any other way and have an individual soldier sitting there constantly questioning whether an order is lawful. Like, well, is it, it's 5 o'clock, it's the end of the workday, but the commander just told me to go mop the bathrooms. Is that lawful? Like, no, you have to operate from a position of lawfulness. And it's a question of law, not fact, as to whether an order is lawful. It's up to the, in this case, in the military system, the military judge to decide that. And what that leads to is unless an order is facially unlawful, if you're in a position to make that call, so we're talking like a My Lai massacre type situation to pull from the real world, you're going to have a duty, a legal duty and a military duty to follow that order. Here, it's a gray area. I don't think that the Order 66, and I want to get you guys to jump in on this as well, because it's just a fascinating topic. Under scrutiny, under any level of scrutiny whatsoever, I don't think it stands up. But are the clones in any position to say, well, hey, that doesn't seem right? Like Ahsoka Tano doesn't seem like she's committed treason. Do they have any kind of facts that would allow them to question it? I mean, you from Commander Rex's standpoint, I don't think he does. Ahsoka's been loyal and faithful. She's left the Jedi Order, but they just got done with a battle in which she helped capture one of the galaxy's most notorious fugitives. And she's been nothing but good. But this is an order from the highest military authority in the galaxy. Maybe he knows something. He's privy to information that they aren't. It's also, interestingly enough, under Article 94 of the UCMJ, it's considered mutiny or sedition to fail to suppress a mutiny or sedition that you know is happening. So you almost like an aider and abettor. And so then you question whether Rex, once his chip was removed, had a duty to stop it and to come to Ahsoka's defense. Realistically, I think, if we're trying to like hammer this into a real world court situation, I think it goes to trial and the judge is going to have to make a tough call on the lawfulness of the order. And if it's assumed lawful, or if it makes it past that gate, then you're into the clones having to put on a defense, whether that's probably a mental capacity defense of some type related to the chip that's installed, some other type of circumstance. So there's a lot to unpack there. I don't want to override the entire episode. Before we started recording, I said I wanted to have sort of a three-way discussion on this one. So I'm looking forward to your thoughts.
So I'll jump in first with part of this. Orders have to be legal. And looking at one of the legal definitions is where the order is apparently regular and lawful on its face, he, as in a soldier, is not to go beyond it to satisfy himself that his superior has proceeded with authority, but is to obey it according to its terms, the only exceptions recognized to the rule of obedience being cases of order so manifestly beyond the legal power or discretion of the commander as to admit of no rational doubt of their unlawfulness. So that's part one, and that's old law. So it's because it's quoting one of the old British scholars on the law of war, but it's from U.S. v. Kinder from 1954, and there's no duty to follow unlawful orders. And there's this wonderful quote by Judge Washington in 1813 that states, "It is repugnant to reason and to the positive law of the land. No military or civilian officer command an inferior to violate the laws of his country, nor will such command exercise, much less justify the act." And that's U.S. v. Jones from 1813. Now, putting this together, Palpatine doesn't outright say that the Jedi are like leading an insurrection to overthrow the government. We have due process. Now, things get a little murky with the fact that the Jedi did try a military coup. So like, that's not good from one count of the Jedi are traitors, but that skips a whole lot of due process and states that there's a military action, literally an insurrection against the Republic taking place. And to order, if you see somebody, shoot them, that doesn't sound lawful. That does not sound lawful on its face. And then this turns into an issue of capacity to recognize that the order is unlawful, which then gets us to the mental capacity discussion, which will be next. Stephen, what would you like to add to the lawful unlawfulness of Order 66?
Yeah, I find it really interesting that how I've always found military law really fascinating. And it strikes me that the lawfulness, quote unquote, I'm wondering if Thomas had any thoughts on, it seems like a pretty low bar to establish that your average service member should understand whether something is manifestly unlawful, but the lawfulness is defined in terms of law of war, sort of law of the United States, federal law. Is there some sort of standard by which we attribute sort of the average service member's understanding of what is legal?
Yeah, that comes into play more often than anyone would probably be comfortable admitting. I mean, you've seen several high profile courts martial over the last decade, really, from Chief Edward Gallagher, the Navy SEAL that was prosecuted and ultimately convicted and acquitted, split verdict, related to the death of an ISIS fighter. You can go all the way back to a number of killings of civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq that have wound their way into military courtrooms. And oftentimes, this isn't always just one individual acting alone. Quite frequently, I think about there's a case, there's a Stryker kill team. So Stryker's an armored combat vehicle. These folks were going out on patrol and basically just killing several Afghan civilians and then setting up the scene to look like it was a firefight and a quote unquote good kill. And the question arose because a number of these soldiers were junior ranking to a staff sergeant that was exercising a lot of influence and control over these younger soldiers, whether they had a duty to sort of step in here. Clint Lawrence, the guy that was just recently pardoned by President Trump for murdering some Afghan civilians on a motorbike. He had ordered his guys to open fire on this motorbike. That's another example. It's a reasonableness standard. And so you're looking at, it's not some specially crafted scenario standard necessarily from that's custom built for the military, but what was reasonable under the circumstances. And that's why a lot of these cases become so controversial, because you have voices on one side of the aisle saying, well, it's a combat situation, it's rapidly evolving, I'm making the best decision that I can in a split second, versus folks on the other side saying, well, you should have clearly seen, like, who couldn't have seen that this was just a bunch of civilians that you opened fire on? And it's very, very factually dependent. And this is where you get the military jury exercising their discretion. And when you look at these cases and especially the criticism of them from folks that many times have not served in uniform, you have to remember that a military jury is judging these folks. So there's almost an added layer of protection there, because you're getting folks who do serve and in many cases have served on combat tours and have fought in combat, looking at these factors and judging it. So there's sort of an unwritten layer of protection there. For the clones, it's going to be tough for them to say that they had to act immediately on this order. I mean, Ahsoka's standing there on the deck of the Star Destroyer, not doing anything. And effectively, and this, I think, goes to Josh's point, you're getting an execute on site order. I don't care what they're doing. They're now enemies of the Republic. They've committed some untold act of treason, and they're to be killed. And it's not for you, clone, to question what their specific treason is or how deep it goes. You are taking orders from me, the chief executive here. So it's a fascinating question. I think ultimately it's sort of like in none of the scenes that we see play out in Revenge of the Sith, and certainly in this episode, and even in Fallen Order, the whole point of Order 66 was to catch the Jedi off balance. I mean, they're in the middle of leading combat operations. In no case that we've seen on screen do we see any Jedi presenting a threat to the clones. And that's where I think the problem comes into play in terms of the lawfulness. And I don't think it would stand a chance under any kind of scrutiny to stand up as a lawful order.
So with that aside, we now turn to capacity. Because if the clones followed in the legal order, that's murder. And that's a problem for them. If it's a lawful order, they're just following orders that were lawful. And then they have to learn to sleep at night with the fact that they murdered their friends. That's something for the therapist to work out. But let's focus on the legal issue. First off, I did break out my Captain Rex Black series that I did order from Hasbro long ago.
Look at that handsome devil.
Yeah. Well, it was an early morning. I think I ordered one for either Thomas or Steve Chu. I don't remember which, but I said, I'll get two because one of these guys is going to need it because these are hard to get. And they sold out in like the first hour. But that's a long way of saying Rex is one of my favorite Star Wars characters now. He's loyal, he's hardworking, he's decent. And when he's given the order, you can see him fighting it because he knows it's wrong. And the way he shakes, and he's literally fighting the chip because he knows this is a wrong thing to do. So that raises the issue of the insanity defense. And there's a whole bunch of different versions to it. States have different spins on it, and the federal government has its own definition. And having the insanity defense is part of a just society, because we don't want to be executing people who don't understand the wrongfulness of their actions. Now, that doesn't mean they get a free pass for crime, but two wrongs don't make a right. That said, how do we break this down? Stephen, do you want to take the issue of describing the federal standard for the insanity defense?
Right. Well, I just want to note that for the listeners that there was during that pause, Thomas sort of disappeared out of the frame in the Zoom window here and then returned with his Rex helmet on. And it was amazing. I can't wait to see the full costume.
I thought about suiting up in it for the episode, but there's no way to get to effectively record with it. I would sound like I'm recording through like on the other end of a tunnel or something.
Oh my gosh, and I can't imagine it's comfortable to sit in for a very long period of time too, but
no, you'd hear me with very short commentary.
That's amazing. Well, yeah, I think the standard for I know in California for establishing that that you are not guilty by reason of insanity, it requires you to show that you have a mental disease or defect that results in your inability to distinguish between right and wrong at the time that you committed the crime. It's not something that occurs later. It's when you were committing the crime. And by the way, it's something that it's a defense. You're convicted first, and then once you're convicted, the judge instructs the jury that that we see that there's been a crime committed, but we can not punish this person in the way we ordinarily would punish this crime if you can establish that they were unable to understand that the conduct that they were engaging in was unlawful or was wrong. So it's a pretty high standard for people to meet. We generally in our legal system assume that people are capable of understanding the consequences of their conduct. And so we ordinarily don't let people off the hook for their criminal conduct when they're sort of heat of the moment or crimes of passion. We still convict them. We still incarcerate them for that conduct. So the insanity defense is pretty high to establish, but it strikes me that that the way that insanity nullifies the intent requirement or the mens rea requirement for a conviction of criminal conduct maybe have sort of this analog in the idea that Order 66 is not so much a legitimate military order, but it's more like a trigger phrase than in speculative fiction where it's triggering an inability to resist the order in a way that may be kind of an insanity defense. It undermines the free will of the person in the way that a mental illness might. And so they may be able to avail themselves and meet this kind of high standard of being able to show that they didn't appreciate the unlawfulness of their conduct.
And if they're being prosecuted in a military court, the standard is the same. The UCMJ in Rule for Court Martial 50 Alpha basically subsumes the federal standard. So there's no daylight between those two. What's interesting is that even though the military case law largely mirrors the federal case law on it in terms of, I mean, there's not much difference in terms of standards, what is a mental disease or defect, and your ability to appreciate wrongfulness, that sort of thing. Interestingly, there's a specific procedure that a military judge, or excuse me, a military jury has to complete when they're in deliberations. They actually have a bifurcated voting process. So they vote first on guilt or innocence, and then assuming the accused is found guilty, they have a second vote on the matter of mental responsibility. And at least in our system, the defendant, the burden shifts. So we know in all criminal cases, the burden is not on the defendant to prove innocence, but since this is an affirmative defense, it's constitutional to shift the burden back to the defendant to put on sufficient evidence to mount the defense. They've got in the military system to demonstrate this mental disease or defect by clear and convincing evidence, which is a fairly high standard. I mean, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, certainly, but it's up there. And so it really is, a just as it is on the civilian side, a tough hurdle to get over to get the benefit of the defense. And the interesting twist here is that these chips were so cleverly hidden, as we saw in not only this episode, but during the sort of quote unquote lost season of the Clone Wars. I mean, it took like an atomic brain scan, I think was the term, to find the chip in Tup, the clone that we see get brought back to Kamino in season 6. I don't know that they're going to have the benefit of that information. I mean, unless Rex is coming out of hiding to testify or has a sample, it's so carefully guarded that, what are you going to do? What's a clone going to look to that? Like, hey, I felt something was weird and I started repeating good soldiers follow orders or something. You know, it's odd.
It is. And it's highly problematic because they kill lots of people and lots. So it does raise the issue of, what does that chip do? Does it eliminate the clone's inability to understand right from wrong? The fact that Rex was fighting it tends to show that there is some agency, but maybe that's just because of his personality. Others might have just been it erased their ability to understand right from wrong. Now there, we could go down the rabbit hole of the irresistible impulse, which we got rid of in California. So, the issue is, do they understand the wrongfulness of their actions? And I think some did, just by Rex's body language, because he literally fights it. And he's giving information to Ahsoka while trying to kill her. So that shows a couple things. One, he still had some control. Two, he couldn't control himself from trying to harm her. So there's, again, I would be comfortable defending a clone trooper if they did off any Jedi, because I do think that chip is exhibit A to showing a mental disease, that it's like literally there was a chip inside their brain that overrode their thought process, their agency, their capacity, and their ability to discern right from wrong, and they go on a murder spree of Jedi.
Well, even, I wonder, this is another layer to it, because the default stock explanation for that, the chip, is that when it was discovered, like, oh, that's to suppress Jango's overly aggressive nature. You see the Kaminoan doctors, come up with a plausible explanation for it. And so this must be something else, like a virus that has caused this. So I think what you're going to need is that little droid AZI-3, the little droid that helps out Fives in the episode. Find him on Camino. He's your expert witness. He just sort of cutely hovers up to the witness stand and very calmly walks the jury through everything.
That would be adorable, and people would find him very credible. So I'd be happy to have him as a witness. Plus the voice was just super sweet. So yeah, show me a cute droid and you're going to have a very sympathetic jury. Speaking of droids, let's defer that because that's talking about the episode. Let's stick to the law. Once Rex is free of the chip, he shoots a few clone troopers who are shooting actively at Ahsoka. I don't know if he stuns them or if he kills them, but it raises an interesting question with defense of others when you know that the people that you're shooting can't control their own actions. So I hope he just stunned them, because if he didn't, he's going to have some really big guilt going, well, they were a threat to her. They were trying to kill her. So I do think it is justified to, you know, it is a perfect defense of others defense. But if you know that the people you're shooting can't control themselves and you kill them, I think that's a problem. Because Ahsoka goes to great lengths not to kill any clones, because she's cool like that. And did you guys have any reaction to that you want to share?
I love the juxtaposition between Ahsoka sort of frantically, you know, just trying to push them out of the way and you know, deflect bolts as she can, not necessarily right back into the soldiers, and then Maul on his Vader style Rogue One killing spree down the hallway. This sort of ties back in with the mutiny and sedition piece that we talked about earlier. This is Rex, Commander Rex, excuse me, fulfilling his duty as a military officer to put down an actual mutiny or sedition. I think there's an open question about whether Ahsoka is a lawful military authority. I think she's been vested with that authority on some level by Anakin or Obi-Wan. But she has no official status in the Grand Army of the Republic. So there's an open question there. But Rex, as sad as it is, has a duty to put that down. They are clearly committing a crime here, in my opinion, attacking a military commander, by whatever definition you want to give to Ahsoka. And so he's got a duty, as tragic as it is, to defend her and to stop it. And even under military law, when you look at a murder charge under the UCMJ, they still recognize the defense of others defense, just like civilian courts do. So I think he'd be protected on two fronts. I would happily represent him.
Yeah, I think the essence of a defense of others defense is that the threat is actual and imminent. And I can't think of anything that's sort of more imminent and actual than like a room full of clone troopers barging in and opening fire. So I agree. I think Rex has a pretty sympathetic defense here of defense of others of Ahsoka.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about something we skipped over just a little bit with Maul. Because with Maul, he's put into a chamber so he can't use his force abilities. It looks like a muzzle across his mouth. His hands are shackled. And there's a lot of restraint to keep him from using his force abilities to escape it. And those devices on Mandalore were outlawed. So this was the last one that they had and to incarcerate a force user. And do you think that was legal, Stephen? Was that proportional in being able to, you know, hold a force user in captivity, even if it's, you know, to be, you know, tried? Because we've seen Ahsoka break out of prison cells. So What are your thoughts?
Exactly. I think it's worth remembering that just a few episodes ago, Ahsoka was incarcerated and just got out of the cell simply by flicking the off switch to the containment field with her mind. And so I think the Mandalorians from the Great Hyperspace War remember how hard it is to keep Force users detained and keep them, in their view, safely removed from people who they would harm. And it's interesting because I've been thinking of this in terms of Maul being a pre-trial detainee, because he hasn't been yet convicted of any crimes. They certainly have probable cause to arrest him and detain him for trial. We talked previously about his very long list of crimes and his involvement in criminal enterprises and the evidence that's against him. So any neutral magistrate judge would likely have issued a warrant for his arrest. But in the U.S., it's sort of the due process implication that kind of merges with the Fourth Amendment seizure requirements. But once you're a pretrial detainee, once you're captured by the authorities, it kind of shifts from being a Fourth Amendment seizure to more of a due process conditions of incarceration. And the Supreme Court has held that the authorities can, quote, employ devices that are calculated to effectuate a detention. But on the other hand, there's a line that the authorities can cross if it becomes conditions that amount to punishment. Because remember, they haven't been convicted yet, so there's no authority to actually punish the detainee. And the intent to punish can be established by sort of an express intent, like something that the authorities say to the person, or the use or restrictions of conditions of confinement that are not reasonably related to a legitimate goal. But as we've said, the Force users are very difficult to keep restrained. So I think maybe some sort of device like the one that the Mandalorian one would be reasonably related to keeping Maul or any Force user restrained. On the other hand, the device itself was really decorated, like it seemed like it was meant to be used to kind of parade people or detainees through sort of throngs of people that might be deriding the person who is being imprisoned. And so maybe there's an argument that it was meant to sort of be a cruel and unusual due process violation for people like to be restrained like this, but it seems like given the difficulty of keeping a Force user restrained, it seemed maybe reasonably related to that goal. And I have a whole other rant about like how this device is so effective narratively, but I'll hold off on that one too.
No, go for it. Let's Thomas and I are ready to break out popcorn.
Oh my gosh, I've been thinking about this so much. I think it's such an interesting design decision by the showrunners to, in some respects, I expected the show to put the viewer in the position of the Jedi and to make them experience this sort of horrific genocide or, sort of campaign of death against them. But I never expected them to put us in Maul's point of view. And it just struck me how the device that he's in has just this little tiny window that he's able to see out of, but he's muzzled in the same way that the audience is put in this position of having to observe this horrible thing that we're all sort of scared of, but unable to warn our heroes or unable to do anything to prevent it. It was so effective and so oppressive. I thought it was just a really, really remarkable storytelling choice, and I just really admired it.
That's phenomenal. The art on it, to your point, also just evoked the mural that is behind Maul and Savage Opress when they get their asses kicked, excuse my language, by Sidious when he comes off the throne and comes to Mandalore to put an end to their shenanigans. There's this that great big mural from the Mandalorian War against the Jedi, and now he's sort of, that's the last time that he got captured and ultimately imprisoned, and here he is once again surrounded by Mandalorian art. I went back because I said, we've seen something like this before, And it seems like the Empire took a lesson from the Mandalorians, because in season one of Rebels, we see Kanan and the rest of the Spectre crew go over to Stygian Prime, the same prison where Maul had been imprisoned, and try to rescue Luminara Unduli. And she, her remains are locked in a similar looking sarcophagus. You know, I suspect because it had a window on it, very similar to Maul's, that it was a device used for imprisoning Jedi that the Empire created as the change in regimes happened.
So first off, just artistically speaking, of course they're going to make it nice. These are Mandalorians. They have class, culture. They're educated. They're not just going to have it be like concrete walls with a floor drain. They're going to make it aesthetically pleasing. Secondly, I do think it would be lawful, because what else are you going to do? Because you just can't go like, well, we don't want to hurt him, so we're just going to let him put him into things he can get out of. Like, it's not fun, because it goes to like, how do you have a trial with him? Because this is from case law, the use of physical restraints at trial is governed by two factors. The presence of compelling security concerns and the need to use the least restrictive alternative. What else are you going to do with the magic space wizard that can move things with his mind, who's also a really good fighter and seems a little sadistic and killing people left and right? So you got to do what you got to do so you don't add to the body count. So I don't know if there's a less restrictive alternative for him, or a force user of that magnitude. It does, you know, just to touch on excessive force, is the force used unreasonable in restraining him? I don't think so. Because again, what's the alternative? Just like sedating him constantly? That doesn't seem like a good plan. And it's like you can't keep the defendant in a medically induced coma, because we just don't do that. So there's a lot of issues there on like, how do you just handle with this?
There's that entire episode of Resistance where they capture a First Order stormtrooper and they just keep hitting him over the head and stunning him. They could just take that approach.
That poor guy must have had so much brain damage by the end of it. How many concussions did he have in like a 30-minute window? Not okay. Well, we can go fanboy now. Somebody did very well at film school, because the visual storytelling in this episode is stunning. The first third, maybe half, there's barely any dialogue. They rely on visual storytelling. It's not like, we're going to tell you we're going back to Coruscant. No, it's they use visual medium and soundtrack to convey a foreboding dread. And just the cinematography is so sweeping and cinematic and brilliant. Let this team do whatever they want. Let them write scripts. Let them tell the stories they want to tell about Star Wars.
Yeah, it's Kevin Kiner, right? Is the way you pronounce his last name. The score for that episode was incredibly interesting to me, because when you think of a Star Wars score, especially for the Clone Wars, he really leaned into the brass, sort of the military fanfare aspect of the music of Star Wars. And this episode was like Vangelis, Blade Runner, ambience, kind of electronic at moments, just very low sustained notes under like these otherwise silent moments. It was so evocative, it was oppressive, it was claustrophobic, kind of again mirroring that that sensation of being unable to intervene or to avoid what you know is coming. I just thought it was brilliant. And I was really impressed by the score. I did a whole watch through where I just listened to the music and didn't even pay attention to anything else. It was so good.
It felt like a weighted blanket on top of you the entire time. And what it evoked for me was the portion of the Revenge of the Sith script where Anakin is weighing you get these rapid sort of cuts between him kind of looking out the window and tears are flowing down his face as he's looking over at the Chancellor's office. He knows this confrontation is about to happen and he may lose his chance to save Padme. And it's just this almost like synthesized notes that you hear. It built to that moment where the most powerful scene for me is, Josh, you mentioned it earlier, but Rex is standing there and all you see is his helmet shaking in his arm and it just drops. And what I love about this episode is that, and I read this observation elsewhere, so I won't take full credit for it, but we don't need to see Order 66 fully executed again. This doesn't trot that back out with fanfare or to celebrate it as some kind of cool Star Wars moment. This is about Ahsoka and Rex, and it has always been building to this moment. And the depths to which he attempts to save her, you know, fighting against this biological modification of himself that was unwillingly done, and the depths to which she goes to save him. I would put the moment where she lays hands on him and repeats or says Chirrut's phrase, "The Force is with me and I'm one with the Force." That is now top five to top three Force use moments in the entire saga. I put it up there with Luke firing on the Death Star and that moment with Chirrut in Rogue One. I mean, it was just phenomenal for the Force to be used in that way to achieve what was otherwise medically impossible without more equipment and more time.
Yeah, it is so well done. And Stephen, I'm glad you had the Blade Runner vibe as well. It did remind me of other 80s sci-fi soundtracks. I can't put my finger on it exactly what other ones, but Blade Runner was one that I definitely felt, but I feel there were others, but I don't know what they were. And maybe watching it a few more times and then spend some time on YouTube going through what came out in 83, okay? What came out in 84? Like, because it just, there's something so familiar with that sense of like sci-fi dread, you know, and again, just brilliantly done. I also did cheer for I Am One with the Force on The Force Was With Me. So good that they used it. And in that way, that was awesome. It's just such an exceptional episode, and with a cinematic feel, beautiful visual storytelling, and it's not like we're going to show you and have it narrated at the same time. It's that master class in how to tell a story. And you know, I always think like how could you, like convey that to a jury? Like, you know, when thinking of lawyers as storytellers, that we want a jury to, believe the facts a specific way, and that our client's the good guy in the story, and that they were wronged. Like, that's what lawyers have from a storytelling similarity. And they do such a masterclass in this.
Yeah, I just want to point out, too, I think, Thomas, your observation about this being so personal between Ahsoka and Rex. I thinking back to my English lit and dramatic lit days, this is just a Greek tragedy. There's a sense of inevitability that's the hallmark of classical tragedy that you know something is coming. The audience can see it coming. The participants don't understand the gravity of the situation until it's too late. But it's always personal. It's about a relationship between a family member, like family members, or about between two people that has these sort of far-reaching consequences for the society that gives you that sort of release that tragedy is, the classical tragedy is supposed to evoke for the audience. And I thought the use of the I am one with the force and the force is with me was such a great way to capture that moment of intimacy between Ahsoka and Rex, where she begins saying it and then she and he, the lines between them become so blurred through the force that he starts saying it with her, even when he's in an unconscious state. And I thought it was just so beautifully rendered, both from a classical dramatic sense, but also using the current canon that we have since Rogue One, and the way that we see that force users have this mantra to connect with the force and to connect with each other. I was so moved by it. I'm kind of tearing up right now. it's so good.
That's okay. That's natural. I gotta say, I do love the droids in this, because Ahsoka's cool. The same way that Anakin is good to droids, Ahsoka is as well. And it's like being good to puppies, that the dogs that always love you and will always be there. That's what these R2 units are like, or R1 and R3 units are like, as they're rolling around going, okay, because they freak out too with like, what's going on? None of them are happy. And they all mount up to let's stop this and find out what's going on. So all the droids are on board, and the way that Ahsoka works with them is brilliant. And they all get a gold star because they're all very good boys.
Cheap is Dave Filoni. It's so funny. It's like, is Cheap Topper's sort of distant cousin, or maybe not even distant. They seem like they're really closely related.
Yeah, my brother went down on a Y-wing earlier in the war, but I hope to find him one day and be reunited. I like that the little dish on top just looks like a hat, and you know, we all, if you've seen Dave Filoni, you know he's not going to be caught dead without a hat unless he's forced to, so it's very appropriate.
Absolutely. It's, yeah, this episode has many of the things that I love about Star Wars. We have the Force, we have fidelity, loyalty. Ahsoka doesn't do the I'm just gonna have to kill all these clone troopers to get out of this. Nope. The way that she uses Maul, it's just like, no, I'm not rooting for you. It's like, okay, that's super Machiavellian and well done, because it's like, no, I'm not teaming up with you. You're going to go cause some chaos and a distraction, and this is how you get your fighting chance to live. Cool. That does raise some interesting legal issues, because she lets Maul out of the cage, and he does kill a bunch of troopers, so like that's definitely not good. But I don't think she had a choice. It's not like she could gas the entire ship and then go, okay, three little droids, it's up to us to do complex brain surgery on everybody, who's with me? Like, that's not a reasonable reaction or a standard to hold somebody to. But again, just so well done from a storytelling perspective. Just, it's everything a Star Wars fan could want.
I wonder if it's Filoni's commentary on Darth Vader, like Maul, he likes Maul as a character enough that he doesn't need a lightsaber to wipe out a hallway full of enemy troops.
Well, it's, you're resourceful with the Force, and because the Force is your ally, so Maul is using what he had, and he clearly wanted a lightsaber, and she's like, nah, no, I'm going to need these. You go have fun. And, you know, he does it. I do think about the guy who lost his arm, so, like, that bothered me. But That's just cold, mean.
That's an OSHA violation, isn't it? The doors not having sufficient reopening functionality on them.
But it's, you think of the, like, the fire doors or watertight compartments on board a ship, which is what these effectively are. You don't want it flooding, or in this case, exposed to the vacuum of space. You don't want a fire to be able to spread to other compartments. You know, and even, well, they got rid of it, but there used to be fire suppression with halon that, you know, sucks all the oxygen out of the room to put out the fire. You don't want to be in the compartment when that happens, because you die. And I mean, there are horror stories. Like the Russians on one of their nuclear subs launch lost a significant portion of crew when the halon system went off with people still inside the compartment. So yeah, it's bad. So yeah, I could see losing an arm as part of the risk of being on board a ship of that class. Doesn't make me feel good about it, because that had to hurt. If you've ever slammed your hand in a car door, yeah, imagine it being a couple tons and you just lose the digits. Not a good day. Not a good day. That said, you know, it's May 2nd, so this will go live today because this is our reaction, and we'll record another reaction after the final episode. But did either of you guys jump on what's being released for May the 4th yet? And have you ordered anything for you, for yourselves, or for spouses?
On the Hasbro live stream yesterday, they had that really cool Hanan carbonite 6-inch figure, and then a carbonized Darth Vader, where they put sort of a metallic sheen on him. It was supposed to go live for pre-orders on Amazon yesterday, and that didn't happen. So I'm waiting patiently until that happens. I like the Kamino clone trooper. If you couldn't tell, a sucker for clone troopers. I don't think that figure is coming out until later in the year, but I'll be keeping my eye on that one.
Steven, did you resisted?
Not yet. I'm trying to be patient. I'm trying to, you know, I had an experience when I was really little. Delay the end of this too long, but I once, when I was a kid, I found where my parents had hidden the Christmas presents, and I peeked, and I thought it was being so, you know, I thought it was being so cool, but then I realized that really ruined Christmas morning. so I have this tendency now to try to be patient and to wait for reveals and stuff. So I'm holding off, but I can't wait to see what everything comes out as.
I did place an order because I saw that they were just selling out, like, at different stores. And so I ordered one of the Rebel Hoth troopers. That's the Black Series, because Empire's kind of my movie. I mean, I do remember seeing Star Wars in the theater, but it's, like, super hazy. Like, it's merged with my life type of memory, that I can't discern actually seeing it. It's just always there with me. But Empire, I clearly remember seeing, and that experience, and the experience Christmas morning 1980. And so I thought, like, I gotta get one. And I probably, I'll probably get the 3.75 one on the card as a Christmas gift to my cousin, because he had that as a kid. So, and he also had the Hoth turret and all that goods in, which I think came with the probe droid. Regardless, yeah, the probe droid. I didn't, and so yeah, it's just that was one thing I did break down and go, like, I think they're going to sell out. And because I noticed, like, the Luke in the flight suit sold out. A couple others sold out on pre-sales as well. And Thomas, if you were able to get the Hanan and Carbonite, it looks like those sold out prior to even going live. So I don't know if that just.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm out of luck.
Yeah. If friends and family like just bought them all from. But yeah, it was like it went live and they were gone. So, yeah. So anyway, it's I'm enjoying all the love for Empire because I have a good childhood memory of seeing that. And so, yeah, lots of good stuff. And gentlemen, it's been a privilege discussing and, you know, this episode, and we will be back for more. So everyone stay safe, stay inside, wear a mask, and we'll see you all very soon. Take care.